The Mona Lisa, The Last Supper. These masterworks of the Renaissance were painted by the hand of Leonardo da Vinci. He is the archetype of what we think of today as a Renaissance man. His infinite curiosity led him to study anatomy, botany, music, sculpture, design. And, says writer Fritjof Capra, Leonardo da Vinci was also a great scientist. Capra is the author of a new book, The Science of Leonardo, Inside the Mind of the Great Genius of the Renaissance. Hello, Mr. Capra.
Hello, thank you for having me on your show.
Surely. Now, Leonardo da Vinci is now known, of course, to have been a great artist, a great mind, but he was not classically trained in science or math. Tell us a brief story.
No, he was not, but he was classically trained in art. And also in engineering. He lived in a time in the 15th century in Florence where there was a great unification of various disciplines. And he was trained in all these disciplines, but he was not trained as a scientist. In fact, he did not go to university and therefore could not speak Latin or Greek. And that was a big hindrance on the one hand, but on the other hand, it allowed him to not be prejudiced by the classical teachings and to go to nature herself, as he would say, to observe nature systematically.
Exactly. In your book, you write that his lack of classical education freed him.
That's right. And he often commented on that. And one of my favorite quotes is when he said, "When you can go to the well, you don't go to the water jug." In other words, you don't need to read the classical texts, which of course he studied also, but you have a more direct access to natural phenomena. And this is what we now call the empirical method or the scientific method, which he developed single-handedly 100 years before Galileo, who is usually called the father of modern science. So in my view, that honor should really go to Leonardo da Vinci.
Give us a sense of how the other young scientists were approaching their work. What was da Vinci seeing around him that was different?
Well, not science, of course. In fact, the word science was not used in our sense until the 19th century. Instead of science, they would use natural philosophy. And those philosophers would generally just copy Greek texts. So Aristotle, of course, first and foremost, really ruled the day. And then these scholastic philosophers of the Middle Ages, the Christian theologians, fused Aristotelian philosophy and science with Christian doctrine. And so then any contradiction to Aristotle, any even critical reading of Aristotle, was seen as being heretical. And this is the tradition with which Leonardo broke.
His notebooks are full of clues about how his mind worked. For example, Leonardo da Vinci was preoccupied with motion, you write, especially the flow of water.
Yes, and that is a science that is now known as hydrodynamics or fluid dynamics that he really created. That did not exist at all. There were a lot of hydraulic engineers, especially in Lombardy, in northern Italy, who were very talented and very knowledgeable about the flow of water. But Leonardo was the only one who made the transition from engineering to science by asking, how can I represent the flow of water mathematically? How can I describe it in theoretical models? That was absolutely unheard of.
So tell me about some of the experiments that he devised to look at water.
Well, for instance, he did controlled experiments in the laboratory. He designed a glass tank to study turbulent flow, and he painted the wall behind it black. And then he poured water into this tank and colored it or put fine grains of millet or straw into it. And these are techniques now known as flow visualization that are still used by scientists today.
Da Vinci was also interested in patterns that he saw in nature. There are wonderful prints that you include in your book. One is the pattern of rivers on the earth seen from above.
Yes.
And another is the pattern of veins in the human arm. And they look so much alike.
Yes, and this is actually the main thesis of my book. I present a new interpretation of Leonardo's science as a science of patterns, of living forms, of processes of transformation that comes very close often to what we now know as the theory of living systems and complexity theory. For him, to know something always meant to relate it to similar patterns in other fields. And this is why Leonardo sounds so modern to us.
One of my favorite parts of your book is where you talk about how his sense of the mystery of life translated into that enigmatic smile that you see in the Mona Lisa.
Yes, and that is especially true for the later parts of his life, for his old age. That smile appears also in the St. John and in many other figures in his drawings. And in addition to the smile, we often have a finger pointing heavenwards. So that mysterious smile at that finger pointing into the darkness is Leonardo's acknowledgement that nature, in fact, will always be more complex and more mysterious than our human science can explain.
Fritjof Capra, the author of The Science of Leonardo, Inside the Mind of the Great Genius of the Renaissance. Sir, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Let's put it this way. If you have a beer with Eric Weiner, he's likely the guy who'll look into his glass and say that it's half full. Eric spent more than 10 years as a foreign correspondent for NPR News, an experience that's not likely to improve a man's disposition. You know, I was going to change that line because it wasn't clear to me if it meant foreign news or NPR, but now that I hear it, I think we'll just move on. After describing places afflicted with problems, from suicide bombings in Jerusalem to student suicides in Tokyo, Eric became intrigued with finding those places in the world in which people are reportedly happiest, and why they may be so. His new book is The Geography of Bliss, One Grum Search for the Happiest Places in the World. Eric Weiner, who is almost smiling now, joins us in our studios. Eric, thanks so much for being with us.
Almost, but not quite, Scott. I am happy to be here, Scott.
Okay. Well, we take that with new authority with this book. Happiness as a goal or even a purpose in life is a relatively new invention.
It is for most of us, for the special people, the gods. I'm talking centuries ago. It was considered attainable, but it wasn't something that everybody aspired to or was expected to attain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that has created a special kind of unhappiness in our day, the unhappiness of not being happy. You know, there's a lot of pressure in this day and age.
Which is different than the unhappiness of envy. Maybe, of observing other people with more of something.
Right, because you don't necessarily aspire to that. You don't think it's possible to be happy. I mean, happiness went from being this glorious benefit bestowed on the fortunate few to something that each one of us expects to obtain. And expectations and happiness are not necessarily related. They often go in opposite directions.
I think it might be a revelation to people that there actually is a world database of happiness.
The World Database of Happiness. Indeed, it exists in Rotterdam, the Netherlands. In fact, there is this burgeoning science of happiness, and a lot of it is compiled in this one rather unhappy-looking office building in Rotterdam, and it's run by a very kindly Dutch professor who looks a bit like Robin Williams, and his name is Ruth Veenhoven, and he's a pretty happy guy. And I started my search there, and trying to construct a sort of atlas of bliss, I call it. The countries tend to be homogenous, to be honest. They're not the most diverse places. They tend to be fairly wealthy, but the correlation between wealth and happiness is very tricky. A little bit of wealth will buy you a lot of happiness. If you're a Bangladeshi farmer, the best way to make you happy would be to give you more money. But if you're a Swiss or an American person, giving you more money is not necessarily going to make you happy.
Let me ask you about some of the datelines of happiness that you visited. Switzerland first. One of the reasons they might be happy is that things just work well.
Absolutely. This is what the philosopher Schopenhauer called the absence of misery. And for him, that was the definition of happiness. The trains really do run on time. The streets are clean. And, you know, isn't it odd that that Switzerland comes out happier than, say, Italy or France, these southern European countries that we associate with the joie de vivre? And it doesn't work that way. It's Switzerland and Denmark. It's these sort of countries that lead more attenuated lives, humming along at a very pleasant upper rate, but not necessarily hitting these peaks and troughs all the time. But there are other reasons, I think, why the Swiss are happy. One is that they do vote a lot. They vote 7 or 8 times a year in a public referendum, and they have a say in what happens. And having a say in your life is an important ingredient in happiness. They have, I think, a very healthy attitude towards money.
And they have a lot of it.
They have a lot of it.
Yeah.
They're on a per capita basis wealthier than we are. But, you know, in America, we have this attitude of if you've got it, flaunt it. And the Swiss way is if you've got it, hide it. Do not provoke envy in others. And envy, I do believe, is one of the great enemies of happiness. And then there's just this love of the land. The Swiss love their Alps, and they're very grounded in the land. And I think that's an important ingredient in happiness, to feel that connection.
Let me ask about Bhutan. You met a man named Karma. I seemed fascinated by something he said, which is to be happy, you need to set aside maybe 5 minutes a day to think about death.
That really hit home with me. I think that in this country, we do not talk about death. We will talk about anything except for death. We will talk about how much money we make. We'll talk about our sex lives. We'll talk about politics. Mm-hmm. We will not talk about death.
I want to ask about Iceland. Is there something about cold and even darkness that promotes a spirit of togetherness?
I think there is. And I made a point of wanting to go there in the middle of January. And first of all, the cold allows for a coziness. There's a huddling together. There's a closeness of flesh upon flesh and people embracing each other, if not literally, then figuratively. And I have this theory. It's not just me. Others have it as well. And I call it the we all get along together or we die theory. And it basically goes like this. You know, picture yourself in Iceland 1,000 years ago. It was cold. It was dark. It was a difficult, difficult existence. If you wanted to survive, you had to cooperate or you died together. I think a cold climate does promote a closeness of humanity, which is key to happiness, definitely.
So why isn't Russia happier?
Russia and any country that has had contact with Russia in the last 100 years, however glancing that contact may have been, they're unhappy. I mean, statistically, these are the least happy countries in the world. You know, one theory is that there is a darkness in the Russian soul and that the Russians just are a dark people and they like to chew on their misery. And then I don't know. There's an element of mystery as to why the Russians are as miserable as they are.
You happier after doing this book?
That's a tough one. You know, I think about the Thais. And in Thailand, they have an expression that translates as, you're thinking too much. And at first I was like, whoa. Thinking too much. I thought, I'm not happy because I'm not thinking enough. And I think also about the way the Thais say, my pen lie, which means never mind, just let it go. And the other day, my iPod crashed and I lost my entire song collection, about 2,000 songs, and I did not back it up. And after some initial cursing and stomping, I just found myself thinking, my pen lie, just let it go. You know, this notion that Karma Ora brought up, that happiness is not personal. He just thought it was ridiculous that we talk about personal happiness. Happiness, he told me, is 100% relational. And I know that sounds a bit corny and a bit hackneyed, but it's true. So, to answer your question, yes, I am happier, but still grumpy.
Eric Weiner's new book is The Geography of Bliss, One Grump Search for the Happiest Places in the World. And to read an excerpt from Eric's book, you can come to our website, npr.org/books. Eric, thanks so much.
Pleasure,
Scott. I'm very happy you joined us.
The terms veganomicon and vegangelical share the root word vegan. Vegans are people who don't eat meat, dairy, or eggs. But if your idea of a vegan meal is tofu, sprouts, and soy milk, you haven't been introduced to Isa Chandra Moskowitz and Terry Hope Romero. Their idea of tasty vegan food includes asparagus and lemongrass risotto, eggplant, potato, tiramisu, cupcakes, and
the moussaka cream, which is pine nuts and tofu.
And silken tofu and maybe a couple other things. And when you bake it and it comes out, it looks like this gorgeous bechamel, like,
yeah,
cream.
Brown so nicely.
People look at it and they thought it was fake cheese, and I'm like, no, we don't do that.
Moskowitz and Romero have written several best-selling vegan cookbooks. Their latest is called Veganomicon, the Ultimate Vegan Cookbook. The two met in the mid-1990s outside a dive bar on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. They were both in the punk scene, where Romero says food was a major part of the culture.
Like, at any time, you could have a band on your living room floor from Ohio someplace, and, you know, let's make something to eat, you know.
And making best friends in one day, like, that's
right.
What happened. Like, you met somebody over the weekend, they were your best friend by Monday.
Yeah,
and you were hanging out all the time.
What were some of the bands that ended up spending time on your living room floor?
Oh, where to begin?
Yeah.
Probably no one anybody's ever heard of. Like, the most famous one I can think of was Oi Polloi, which are a Scottish punk rock band that are vegan, and they're still around. We drove them around our van to Canada.
But it also sounds like this is food with attitude.
Yes, inadvertently. We really actually try to be accessible and not have quote-unquote attitude.
Right.
So our website actually says vegan food without attitude, because it's not so much about judging you, and, you know, it's more about experimenting and eating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's part, like, of the what we call post-punk. Like, we take those, I guess, the more accessible parts of it, like, if you want to call, like, get up and do it yourself as opposed to waiting
Definitely.
For someone else to make it for you kind of aspect.
Why does the word vegan scare people?
Does it scare you?
No, not really.
I think because it's an ethical choice, and it sounds like a moral judgment to people. And it also sounds like deprivation to people.
Hmm. Terry, would you agree?
Yeah, it's also a funny word. You know, it sounds like a religion or a planet or just something that doesn't sound like a normal part of life.
Hmm. Why? I mean, from experience, why does so much vegan food taste so awful?
Let's see. I think it might be because people don't necessarily get a culinary degree and then decide to go vegan. So they've made this choice and then, you know, have to learn how to cook.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of times people kind of feel that, okay, I've made this decision for one reason or another, and I have to use these ingredients, and they're sort of almost setting themselves up for less, I'm going to now accept less in my food and what it can be.
Hmm. You mean by, you know, just sticking with tofu and tempeh and those muffins that tastes like, you know, prison loaf.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. By not actually learning how to cook.
Right. And thinking, okay.
Because I love tofu.
Yeah, I do too. And it really has a lot of special characteristics and qualities that come out right when you learn how to actually prepare it correctly.
Mm. Yeah, Isa, you actually recommend, if I'm not mistaken, that if someone wants to begin cooking vegan, don't worry about these ingredients like tempeh, for example, but learn how to cook vegetables.
Right, exactly. That was kind of the basis for Veganomicon.
Absolutely.
And so what do you teach people about cooking vegetables?
Well, just the basic methods, like just how to coax the most flavor out of them, and that vegetables do actually have flavor. A lot of us grew up with canned or frozen vegetables that seriously lack flavor. But to eat fresh and seasonally.
Go to your farmer's market.
Exactly.
I imagine you also encourage people to be adventurous. I mean, try those vegetables perhaps you hadn't heard of before.
Yeah, exactly. Especially now with the farmer's markets, we have such a variety of plant-based food to choose from.
Right. Get a purple cauliflower.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Or those cauliflowers that look like
the Romanescos.
Yes, they look like Madonna's bra.
The fractal. Yeah.
Yeah.
The joining of math and vegetables.
Yes.
So perfect.
When you are concocting recipes, do you veganize existing recipes?
Occasionally. Like, we have seitan piccata or the moussaka, things we're not trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great food out there that can easily be translated to, you know, vegan standards just by removing the meat. And it can become something new and exciting even from there. And it's also good to make foods that people like and are familiar with, you know, as like sort of a springboard.
What do you use in these, particularly the baking recipes, what do you use in them to replace butter and eggs?
Believe it or not, it's not that difficult. We use a lot of, we use soy milk as sort of the basis for not only the milk, but it also replaces a lot of the liquids. We mostly rely on vegetable oils like canola and safflower. And a lot of leavening just happens with baking powder and baking soda, like normal stuff, normal supermarket items. Yeah.
What's the thing you do? You add vinegar? Is it to soy milk or something?
Yes, I know, yes.
Yeah, tell us what that does.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of like an old-fashioned...
Depression era.
It really is. It's kind of amazing. They made all these great cakes in that era when I guess there was a big, big scarcity in eggs. And you create a chemical reaction at first with the acidity of the vinegar curdles the proteins in the soy milk. And then later on, when we combine that with dry ingredients, including baking powder and baking soda, you get this explosion where you'll get a lot of carbon dioxide generated, and that creates leavening.
So what does the title of your book, Veganomicon, mean?
Well, if we were to break it down into the Latin, it means the big book of vegan law, but we don't take ourselves that seriously.
Oh, no. It's kind of a joke. Like, we both like kind of nerdy things, like nerdy movies and nerdy culture, and a lot of our friends, you know, like we like to joke about this stuff.
Yeah. Do you still cook for punk bands?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
There's a group called the Shondes, which are a Yiddish punk rock girl band, and, Brooklyn, you know, I made latkes for one of their shows.
Like Terry and Issa, the Shondas are from Brooklyn. Their new album, The Red Sea, will be released Tuesday. Terry and Issa have a public access cooking show, Post Punk Kitchen, which is now on hiatus. If you were able to catch a few installments when it was broadcast in New York or online, then you remember one of Issa's favorite party tricks. How did you learn to play the guitar with oven mitts?
Well, actually, it's just a matter of editing. So I can play the guitar, and then, you know, I just, you know, use the oven mitt, and then we edit some good chords over it.
Ah. Many years of school.
And now we've ruined the illusion.
we'll keep it a secret.
Okay.
Just, you know, you, me, and, oh, 3 million other people.
Okay. All right.
Issa Chandra Moskowitz and Terry Hope Romero are the authors of Veganomicon, the ultimate vegan cookbook. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find some of Terry and Issa's vegan recipes on the Post Punk Kitchen's website. That's theppk.com.
We've all grown up knowing someone like Dr. Smiley, who's an orthodontist, or a vet named Dr. Katz. In my case, it was Rose Buds, who grew up to marry a man named Mr. Reddish, then hyphenated her last name. Get it? Names that sound improbable and amusing. Larry Ashmead, a longtime book editor, has collected hundreds of such actual monikers for his new book, Birth of a Nation. And he joins us from New York City. Thanks very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Who is Bertha the Nation?
Well, actually, it's the only non-real name in the book. It's a drag queen in London who adopted the name.
You began to take a shine to unusual names from the time you were a youngster.
Well, my mother's best friends were Bettina Button and Edith Shirtsleeve. And she didn't wear shirt sleeves.
I don't blame her. It would only expose her to ridicule. And you have a whole section on aptly named professionals.
I don't know which comes first, the profession or the name. There's a dentist named Dr. Fang. There's a gynecologist named Dr. Overy. There's another gynecologist called Dr. Cherry, which I thought was funny, and I think most people do, but they don't.
I've turned a page in your book to some of the aptly named professionals, and in no particular order, of course, probably the most famous is Simon Rattle, music director of the Birmingham Symphony Orchestra.
That's right.
But there's Hugh Fish, who's an environmental engineer, Johnny Worm, who grows peaches in California, Andrew Inches, a videotape editor in New York City.
You have a section in here, too, on people with improbable names who marry each other.
Well, that's a big problem because you get sort of hyphenated names and first names don't go with last names. I called the woman whose married name is Gay Beach and said, I think it's funny. And she said, it's spelled B-E-E-C-H. No laugh.
And Dan Coffey sends along the recollection that his niece married a man with the last name Bean.
That's all right, Coffey Bean.
Yes. And Joseph Cotton's son married a woman named Velvet Satin.
And so she became Velvet Satin Cotton.
Yes. Well, Mr. Ashmead, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's been very nice talking to you.
Larry Ashmead speaking from New York. His new book is Bertha Venation. Go to see her tonight. And hundreds of other funny names of real people. And this is NPR News.
Our series, You Must Read This, starts the new year off with author Diana Abu-Jabir. She remembers discovering the work of her favorite writer when it was cold and dreary outside.
As a child, I took the winter in central New York personally. By January, the sky over Syracuse turned pewter. Some years it got so cold it felt like someone was trying to kill us. It seemed that we lived at the end of the earth. I longed for and dreaded the holiday season, the way it tricked us each year, coaxing us into festivities, only to plunge us back to a season of darkness. The library, at least, was a warm place. That's where I found a collection of the short stories of Anton Chekhov. I was in my first year of high school. I'd never heard of Chekhov, but something about the steady, scholarly gaze and the author's photograph caught my eye. I opened the book and read, "The day was still, cool, and wearisome, as usual, on gray, dull days when the clouds hang low over the fields and it looks like rain, which never comes." I was drawn into the immeasurable spaces of sky and the open Russian steppes. There was something about those freezing depths that corresponded to my sense of winter. He was talking about bone-chilling places and worn-out people, but somehow the beauty of his language lifted everything up, giving it gravity and importance. Chekhov's story, In Exile, takes up the conversation in which a jaded old ferryman tells a young newcomer, "If you want to be happy, the chief thing is not to want anything." Somewhere between the holiday cheer and the dark winter, this writer created new angles of light. Chekhov was a doctor as well as an author, and in each of his stories he turns a strict physician's eye upon hard truths: the inhumane working conditions of the factories, the starving children, the broken families. But he also depicts moments of serene, glowing beauty, as in Gooseberries, describing a man's luxurious swim in a pond. "Ah, how delicious!" he shouted in his glee. "How delicious!" As I read the collection, huddled in my drab room, I flipped to the photograph of the frowning author. I imagine him crossing Russia at night in a horse-drawn sleigh, calling on his patients, dispensing glittering insights upon a sea of darkness. Chekhov said, "People don't notice whether it's winter or summer when they're happy." His stories captured the way people move between their wishes and the cold realities of the world. "Even in Siberia there is happiness," says the narrator of In Exile. Those snowed-in winters of reading would eventually help me become a writer. Even in the coldest, darkest places, there is comfort and joy.
Diana Abu-Jabir is the author of the recent novel Origin, as well as Crescent and Arabian Jazz. You can find several of Chekhov's stories, plus a winter's worth of book recommendations, at npr.org. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Charlie Brown and Snoopy, Calvin and Hobbes, Fern and Wilbur. The kids section of the library is full of stories about children and their animal friends. Artist and illustrator Maxwell Eaton hopes to add his own set of friends to the bookshelf. He's created a series of books about the adventures of Max and his pig, Pinky. Here's North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann.
It's a frigid December afternoon, and Maxwell Eaton is sitting at a table in his apartment in the tiny village of Saranac Lake, New York. Scritch by scritch, he forms the image of a grinning little boy.
Max's head is the hardest part for me. Gotta get that perfect circle.
Eaton is in his mid-20s. He has black curly hair, and he draws with his left hand, scrunched like a kid doodling at a desk. A couple of years ago, he was working as a ski bum in Colorado after graduating from the arts program at St. Lawrence University.
All my drawings were really dark and charcoal and mechanical things.
But sitting around the ski lodge, Maxwell Eaton found himself sketching cartoons on bar napkins.
Kind of out of boredom almost. I was just doodling and I came up with this character that I was just kind of drawing all the time, who finally became Max.
Max the character looks nothing like Maxwell the artist. With his bright red shirt and blue pants, the little boy is sort of like a happier, better-adjusted version of Charlie Brown. His sidekick, who also evolved over thousands of doodles, is a slightly subversive, marshmallow-obsessed pig named Pinky.
I needed the pig to say something or think something and show a little sarcasm almost, and observing these ridiculous things Max was doing, and finally it was just Max and Pinky.
On a whim, Eaton mailed his drawings to a New York City agent who liked them a lot. He then found an editor at Knopf who liked them even more. The first Max and Pinky book, called Best Buds, was published in 2006.
Max and Pinky love adventure. They go here, and we have them out camping at night. Max is looking around the tent, and he says, "Hey, where did the marshmallows go?" And we got Pinky out front with all the marshmallows.
The second Max and Pinky adventure, Superheroes, was published in October, full of snow monsters and volcanoes. One reviewer praised the book for its thick black lines and sublime sense of humor. Elizabeth Blumley is a children's book author who has a particular fondness for Pinky.
How cute is that pig? And it's a flying one. I just love that.
Blumley owns a bookstore for kids in Shelburne, Vermont, called The Flying Pig. She says kids love reading about characters who stick together, even when times are tough.
The friendship between Pinky and Max is just so sweet and hilarious. They're a little bit like, you know, those George and Martha stories of friendship. It has that, I don't know, that smiling feel to them, if you know what I mean by that.
Eaton says the texture of Max and Pinky's friendship grew out of his love for newspaper comics.
I like to think it was kind of the Calvin and Hobbes generation, where I grew up in first grade starting to read Calvin and Hobbes. That was a big part of my childhood, I think, and that's where I get a lot of the timing and just the give and take between two very different characters.
In their finished form, Eaton's sketches are illuminated with the kind of bright, simple colors that you see in Sunday morning comics. Eaton says he's been incredibly lucky finding an audience for his books, which are aimed at kids age 5 to 7. He also had to overcome one really inconvenient fact. He's colorblind.
It was an interesting jump into children's books and what turned out to be very bright illustrations and colorful and everything. In college, I focused mostly on printmaking and drawing.
That's where all the charcoal came in.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. So I kind of shied away from the painting and everything.
With the help of a computer and an art director at Knopf, Eaton finally found just the right palette for Max and Pinky's adventures.
And we're out fishing. "I don't even like worms," this fish says to Pinky. Pinky says, "Have you tried marshmallows?" Always got that on his mind, it seems, the marshmallows. And Max.
The next Max and Pinky story, called The Mystery, will be published next fall. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann in Saranac Lake, New York.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.